Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. On this side of July, Peacock is flying. That's Peacock, NBC Universal's major content play, available through smart TV products and multi-channel operators. One of Peacock's first original series is Intelligence, a clandestine workplace satire. David Schwimmer from Friends fame is one co-star. The other, creator executive producer Nick Mohammed, joins me next in an internet radio exclusive live from London. How is the major programming landscape now that all the key players are playing? Well, CNetNews.com senior reporter Joan Sullivan will drop by with some details and commentary next half hour. Also ahead, NAACP enters a TV development pact with CBS, and it's a groundbreaker. Hallmark announcements aplenty, our classic trivia question, and a few sentences on Dancing with the Stars post-switch. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you commercial-free by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book and more when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. 80 degrees at the top of the hour on this Wednesday afternoon, and we welcome you on this Peacock launch day to the program all about TV's current and future. We have a big show for you today. That's why we're going commercial-free and only one promotional break each half hour. That's great for our guests and greater for you because we want you involved. So if you have a question or comment for our guests, pick up the phone and dial in with this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe. You're on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn Radio. If you're shy about the phone, no problem. We got a chat room going, and it's ready for you. It's SimonApple04, my name, and you will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the phone is on the air, you can connect to others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk, Spreaker, or TuneIn screen. Follow the instructions of other people can be live with you and us. News notes will bring you at the bottom of the hour, but right now, joining us live from London, just past 8 p.m. local time, and an internet radio exclusive, the creator, co-star, and executive producer of one of the first new series on Peacock, Intelligence, Nick Mohammed. Nick, welcome in.
Hey, how are you? You all right?
Very, very fine, thank you. Congratulations for being one of the first series to fly on Peacock.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, you know, it's a bit of an honor, really. And so, we're in good company. And so, it's a lovely thing.
Are you getting any early reaction from us in the States about your series?
I think by all accounts, it's doing well. In fact, I've literally just had an email kind of come through about some nice reviews and so on. And it's kind of strange because. Because obviously the show launched in the UK back in February, and so it's strange to be going through it all again. But obviously in the States, where I think it's got obviously far kind of greater audience that it can reach anyhow, and obviously with David being, you know, a resident stateside guy, that's really exciting. And so it's a nice exciting time.
So, Nick, how did you come to creating Intelligence, and then once you decided to create it, become the executive producer, along with David Schwimmer, your co-star, and also co-star in it?
Yeah, well, so it kind of came about, I'd always wanted to write a workplace sitcom that sort of focused on these quite, you know, sort of day-to-day mundane interactions, but then set it against the huge backdrop states of national security. I just found that quite a sort of a funny area for comedy, and you know, with Duke XQ being a quintessentially British institution, the idea of a quite maverick, rogue, bullish NSA agent sort of coming into that again felt like a fun area in terms of culture clash. And David and I had actually worked on another show. Well, it was actually a pilot that I'd co-written with a woman called Julia Davis over here, and that never got picked up for a series. But David had come over and we workshopped some ideas together, and I guess that was about 2015. It's a few years ago now, and we just sort of hit it off in terms of sort of similar sensibility and sense of humour. And so when I'd had a script commission from the production company Expectation Entertainment, who makes the show. And so I wrote up this idea, this workplace sitcom set in Duke HQ, the idea of an American kind of coming over and having to work alongside the team there. And I sent it sort of relatively informally to David, and he was just yeah, he was sort of on board from the off, really. And, you know, from then on, you know, I mean, I wrote the show myself, but, you know, it's been incredibly collaborative in respect that we're both execs on the show. And so, you know, we've been across everything from sort of story development through to, you know, post-production and marketing and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it was a first for me, you know, my first series where I'd had that level of responsibility. So to kind of be able to lean on a lot of David's experience, you know, has been invaluable. So yeah, it's been a really great journey.
Mm-hmm. What about the workplace you're dealing with, this workplace that's very, very clandestine, that's dealing with all things cyber, if you will? What about that environment made it funny to you, or thought this could be a really good, you know, model for comedy?
I think, I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about the area is specifically because it is quite, you know, sort of shrouded in mystery, you know, naturally because of what they do, they can't be too open about it. So it meant that you could, or that you can slightly play with people's expectations as to what they feel might go on in a place like that behind closed doors. So there's a certain degree of artistic license. You know, you can have stumps of truth in there because, you know, it is a real institution, and likewise with the NSA. But, you know, the real things that kind of go on behind closed doors, and the way people might behave, and the different types of people you might get within those institutions, it's kind of up for grabs. So as a writer, it's quite a fun place to sort of situate your comedy, because you just have a lot of license there. And then also, I guess, with the subject matter, I've always been quite attracted to the idea of, you know, how, because again, it's a real institution, and, you know, sadly there are real atrocities that happen in the world, but you do have these humans who have to kind of deal with this stuff on a day-to-day basis. And I guess it was sort of one of the challenges of the show was trying to sort of find sort of where those sort of blurred boundaries in terms of treading a fine line between dealing with quite sensitive subject matter and where it can become funny. I found that an interesting area as well. And so, yeah, I guess it was those two things in particular that attracted me to that particular, area with the workplace.
Mm-hmm. British television has had a long and distinguished line of both comedy series in the classic situation style and also in the sketch comedy style. Were there certain models of comedy that you decided to tap into for Intelligence, you know, models of comedy that you grew up on that you really wanted to sort of honor in a way with your series?
Well, a little bit, yeah. I mean, I was brought up on really classic British sitcoms, so, you know, certainly in first instance, I mean, a lot of them were like reruns of classic shows from, I guess, the 70s and 80s, but I was kind of watching them in the 90s, I guess. But, you know, things like Fawlty Towers, Dad's Army, Some Others Do Have Them, Blackadder, you know, again, these shows were, I think, very different to kind of what sitcoms tend to be, or at least the fashion of sitcom now, which I think personally tends to be more going towards the kind of comedy drama route. You know, irrespective of whether it's a half hour or 45 minutes or whatever. And so I've always been drawn to those quite classic, quite superficial sitcoms, which effectively reset every episode. They put a lot of emphasis on the comedy and the gag rate as opposed to, I guess, sort of telling a particularly emotional story, say, that's maybe been quite a little bit more fashionable of late. And so, yeah, I drew a lot of kind of inspiration from those, but, you know, going more contemporary, you know, undoubtedly programs like The Office, both The Office over here and The American Office, and programs like The Thick of It and Veep and 30 Rock, and I mean, even the Naked Gun films, you know, in terms of some of the physical comedy and the silly sort of cartoonish nature of it, you know, I'm a big fan of all those shows. And I hope that, you know, what Intelligence sort of hopefully did is to sort of amalgamate, you know, some of those different types of comedy. You know, there's quite a lot of sort of back and forth, quite a lot of quick dialogue with I hope quite a high gag count, but there's also plenty of kind of character comedy and physical comedy in there as well.
What was David Schwimmer's motivation for being in this series? I mean, we all know him from Friends. He's a very iconic character, and it seems that in reading the description of the series, that, you know, in Friends, he's a very likable character. All the characters were played by David and Lisa Kudrow and Jennifer Aniston and so forth are very likable. Mm-hmm. here he seems to come across as a very unlikable fish into, not just fish out of water, because he comes to the United States and England, but also fish in deep water, given A, the agency he's coming to deal with, and B, meeting you, who comes off as a very inept sort of, cryptomaniac kind of agent.
I guess you probably have to ask David that question, but I guess from knowing what he's said in previous discussions on this, I mean, I think he was obviously attracted to the idea of playing a particularly kind of bullish American in terms of he's kind of very alpha, he's very inappropriate, and there was often like the danger of as worrying, oh, well, you know, is this sort of verging into a kind of cliche territory, especially with me as a British writer kind of writing an American character in this way. But then it was strange, you know, David and I chatted a lot about, you know, the backstory of his character and things like that. And, you know, the more we realized that, you know, we were sort of presenting this sort of typically, I guess, white, maybe Republican-leaning American who would sort of stumble kind of upwards into a position of power, but, you know, can still be kind of inappropriate and get away with it. And we realized that, well, there are plenty of sort of prominent figures, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic in positions of power who kind of represent that still. And so, you know, intelligence isn't, I wouldn't say it's a satire by any means. It's more of a, you know, a gaggy, quirky sitcom. But it's, I think part of the attraction for Schwimm was to, you know, to play that kind of arrogant fool. And, you know, it's a world away from, like, what you see, you know, what he's best known for, I guess, is playing Ross and Friends. So it's a world away from that. And it's a different, you know, different type of character performance. And so, yeah, I think that was one of his reasons. And, you know, that sort of romance, sort of weird, odd couple relationship that his character and my character have in the series, which sort of develops over the course of the six episodes a little bit. That was sort of founded in that very early meeting of David and I when we would improvise together. And we really liked particularly a dynamic where I would play very low status, very inept, and he would play this, you know, very similar to Jerry, this sort of bullish alpha character who effectively kind of adopts my character. But I guess they both sort of solve each other's problems in a way. David's character is looking for someone who can buy all of his BS, for want of a better word. And, you know, my character just looks up to him because, you know, this American coming over and coming into the workplace, it feels so exotic. And so he almost represents like an older brother figure to him in that respect. And so, yeah, they kind of, they're well matched in that way.
Mm-hmm. Did either of you or both of you do any research before shooting where you went inside a government agency like this so that both of you or either of you could get some sort of lay of the land?
we wish. I mean, obviously those places are quite closed shops. And so, you know, certainly GCHQ, you know, they've got a press department, and that, you know, they were in touch with us when they heard about the show. And, you know, naturally they were, you know, wary of being portrayed in a particular way. And so, you know, we had some very open conversations. They quickly, I think, realized that we were, you know, a silly sitcom. You know, we weren't whistleblowing. We weren't making a political point or anything like that. There's no kind of hidden agenda with the show in that respect. And if anything, hopefully it's a celebration of particularly GCHQ and you know, the work they do and the people who work there. So we did what research that we could online. I'm sure that we probably pinged a few alarm bells in either MI5, GCHQ or MI6 or NSA, possibly. But, you know, what was important to us, because we were presenting real institutions, was that there was some credibility there in the presentation of those workplaces, but that we had then artistic license to sort of go wherever we wanted, because we were a barefaced comedy rather than a drama that was trying to sort of, you know, dramatize real specific and real events.
Intelligence from Sky Studios is one of the first original series that's happening today on Peacock. Today is the launch day of that service from NBC Universal. It's available on smart TV sets, smart TV devices, and multi-channel operators from coast to coast in the United States. We're speaking with Nick Muhammad. He is the creator, co-star with David Schwimmer, and executive producer of Intelligence. He joins us live from London in prime time from where he is, and it's still afternoon where we are. This half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Delighted to have you with us on the special midweek edition of the program all about TV's current and future, all about Peacock today. And if you have a question or a comment for Nick, make the phone ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Second of three episodes we're doing this week. Coming up on Friday, we will preview The Alienist, Angel of Darkness, the new TNT follow-up miniseries to last year's big hit. We've got the showrunner of the series, Stuart Cullen, will be with us. And then we will have the series producer of the brand new public television series now on Weekday Afternoons called Camp TV, giving children all over the country a summer camp experience through their television set. Melinda Toporoff, the series producer and writer, will be joining us. That's all coming up Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Swabby Televised. And next Monday, among our guests, we'll have an executive from Tegna, the famous TV station group, about Justice Network, a 24/7 multicast service that later this month turns into True Crime Network. We'll also have with us in another intermedia exclusive, maybe the best choreographer on television, Margaret Derricks. Currently, she's doing The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon. She may get an Emmy Award nomination soon for her latest work. She is also the only choreographer ever to win the Emmy Award 3 years in a row and the MTV Movie Award 5 years in a row. Margaret Derricks, live with us Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Nick, when you have so many hats, you're writing the show, you're co-starring it with David Schwimmer, he's also an executive producer with you, you're both executive producers, how do you juggle the responsibilities?
That's a good question, I guess. A lot of those different responsibilities take place at different times. You know, when you're writing a show, you kind of got your writing head on and your producer head on a little bit as well. Particularly We're writing season two at the moment, which we're starting to shoot, hopefully, all being well, in September. And you go into that with one hat on. But then usually when it comes around to shooting, you're sort of, I've got my kind of actor head on. I mean, one of the good things about us both being execs on it, but also, there's other execs on the show, we've all kind of got an eye on each other. So if I have, if I've got a particularly acting heavy scene, then I know that David or someone else has got an eye on me, and then vice versa. If it's the camera's on David, then, so we can all kind of chip in. But there were definitely times when it was quite full on because, if there were the odd rewrites to do overnight for a scene that we were shooting the next day and you've got lines to learn and, there's some kind of logistical production thing that you kind of need to be across as well. Sometimes it was quite full on, but, it's super enjoyable. And, then you get to the edit and, you're looking at that with a whole different hat on as well. So, yeah, it's kind of great to see a project from, incarnation, creating a show all the way through to it being distributed. I mean, with it being my first one as well, so much of it has been fascinating. I feel like I've learned a lot as well. So, yeah, it was great fun.
Yeah. Many of the classic British situation comedies usually have one writer or two writers, and they write all the episodes. Of course, in British television, a lot rather have like 20 or 22 episodes now, as U.S. television does, or 13 and 10 in this new Netflix, programming era of, plentiful programming, as opposed to peak TV or so forth. It's usually been something like 5 to 10 episodes of series in British television. When you're the sole writer, as opposed to working with a team, what is it like to be that, when knowing that it's all under your bailiwick?
There's a certain amount of pressure. There's nowhere to hide as well. If someone doesn't like your show, then you just have to bear the brunt of that, as in when it, finally goes out, if a critic or members of the public or, if anyone, naturally you can never please absolutely everyone. No show in the world has sort of managed to please absolutely everyone. But so you have to, you take the rough with the smooth, but similarly, the kind of the reward and the satisfaction of kind of writing it yourself, is all yours to kind of to bask in some respects. And so it's nice, but then there's a lot of, as much as I write the script, we have story producers who I will chat to and who will talk to me about ironing out any kind of plot holes or story things, or, you know, we'll talk about character. And so, you know, it's still a process, and I'll deliver a first draft, and, you know, at least five or six people will weigh in with different sets of notes, and then I'll go and redraft, and then, you know, we might jump on a call together. And so, you know, it's a long process. Sometimes it can be quite daunting trying to sort of, you know, manage notes that might come from the channel, notes that might, say, come from David or from other execs on the show. And then equally, you know, there's what I also think, you know, needs to happen in the show, or a particularly, you know, a particular scene, how it should be scripted. I'll have my own opinions as well. So sometimes it can be about a balance and a bit of compromise. But, you know, often we've all been on the same page in terms of, you know, what's funny and you know, the ways that we want the stories to go. So yeah, it's actually, I would say, been relatively trouble free. You do hear horror stories of people when they're just single handedly writing a show where, you know, it ends up being sort of fiddled with to a degree that they don't feel they kind of retain any sense of authorship. And yeah, I've certainly not had that experience. I can't really strictly compare it, because I've also never been one of those people who've been in a writer's room, you know, with a bunch of people, you know, writing on a series. So, you know, I don't have anything to compare it to in that respect. But yeah, I've always written on my own, weirdly, or just with one other person. Always found that, yeah, just really fun.
As both you and David were producing these episodes, did you find that there had to be a major course correction, let's say, either a subject you wanted to cover that you didn't think you were going to cover it, and that we've got to do this in these episodes, or a different shift in character development as both of you were getting your rhythm of your characters?
A little bit. I mean, it's you know, sometimes a blessing and a curse. We didn't have a pilot, so, you know, we went straight to series. And so in some respects, you sometimes want a pilot, because you want to iron out any, you know, you want to get it on its feet and try it out, see what it looks like. But, you know, I mean, in some respects, we were doing that, but with a whole season, well, six episodes. So there were times when we would sort of just check in and make sure things weren't getting too big or not credible. But then equally, it's such a fine line, because it is such a sort of silly comedy. And, you know, there were moments when we would allow ourselves to improvise, and that was sometimes factored into the schedule. And a lot of the time it was about making choices in the edit, because, you know, we would have options for scenes where we'd done different takes or tried out different lines. And, you know, then it just becomes about, you know, a decision on what we feel is kind of the best, the funniest line or the funniest sequence for the show. So yeah, often if I was writing something and it felt like the particular subject area was maybe sensitive, or that we were maybe treading a bit of a fine line, I would often write two versions of that scene, and we would possibly sometimes shoot both. And so we would have those options in the edit. So we would kind of cover our backs in that way a little bit, so that we could, you know, if there was ever any kind of debate, we could sort of save that call for the edit, when we can really sort of see the bigger picture a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. If Peacock and Sky give you a second season, how would you and David like to expand what you did with these episodes?
Well, we're very lucky that it was already announced that we got a second season back in February, just before this season ended in the UK. So I've actually been very much working on that right now, and, you know, we start filming in September, all being well. So yeah, I don't know how much I can give away, but it slightly picks up on there's a bit, I don't want to give a spoiler, but there's a big moment at the end of episode six in season one, and we very much pick up where we've left off for season two. It just broadly speaking, I can say that it deals with a very specific new cyber weapon that they're trying to sort of get a hold of that's fallen into the wrong hands. And Jerry is very sort of, David's character is very key to the success of them obtaining this weapon and preventing it from doing damage to the world. So yeah, the stakes are higher. Hopefully it's really building on what everyone has loved about season one. And yeah, there's a few surprises in there as well, which I won't say, because it'll spoil things.
Well, before we go, with the coronavirus pandemic, I know that British television is starting to get back into production. How is the whole thing going post-pandemic?
Yeah, it's weird. It's going to be, and it's going to get weirder before things return to any sense of normality. I was actually filming on a show on Friday, and that was the first filming I'd done since lockdown and the pandemic. And yeah, I mean, you know, just the amount of precautions in place, and you know, we're currently looking into all that for season two, and how we're going to shoot that, and how we might have to adapt some of the ways we shot season one to account for the fact that there's going to have to be less bodies on set, and we're probably not going to be able to have two cameras on set and do a lot of this single camera. So, you know, it poses quite a few creative challenges, but you know, our show, we're quite lucky in some senses, because it's a relatively small cast and we film pretty much on one set. We're not going from location to location, which I think is where a lot of the filming will kind of come under a lot of, you know, there's tons of restrictions. Basically, any time where you might encounter the general public, it's going to be difficult. Whereas, because we can be a bit of a closed outfit and literally almost quarantine ourselves off in the studio, and you know, obviously there'll be testing and stuff before we start shooting, that can be done. But yeah, it's going to be very strange. I know that obviously a lot of the networks and studios want to get up and running again, though, because you know, everyone wants to be working again. But you know, we're only ever really going to go ahead when it's safe. But you know, there's been so much work done on how we can create safe working environment in that respect, and it's just lots of testing, lots of temperature testing, limiting, you know, drastically limiting the number of people who are allowed on set, even to an extent of maybe even doing our own makeup, which will be interesting. it'll be an interesting time.
Intelligence, co-starring David Schwimmer and Nick Muhammad, now available to you through Peacock, the new mega programming service from NBC Universal that began today on smart TV sets, many smart TV devices, and multi-channel cable operators after a three-month trial on Comcast cable systems around the country. To find out where Peacock is available in the area and how you can get it, here's where you go online, www.peacocktv.com. That's www.peacocktv.com. Intelligence, already set for a second season that will hopefully go into production this fall. Nick Muhammad, creator, co-star, and executive producer of this series, thank you again for taking out a prime time out to join us on your opening day for Peacock. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Congratulations to you, Dave, and all the rest of the crew where you are at Sky Studios for making it happen. And again, congratulations on the second season.
Thank you so much. Thanks very much for talking.
It's a pleasure, Nick. Take care. Enjoy the night.
Take care. You too. Bye.
Nick Muhammad from Intelligence joining us live from London. Now time for our classic trivia question of the week. And if you're first with the correct answer, we've got a pair of Peacock commemorative products for you. One is a 500-piece, not kidding, 500-piece jigsaw puzzle under the logo Can't Not Watch, plus an activity book with a lot of great things for you and your family. And they can be yours if you know the answer to this question we first posed on Monday's episode. Name two of the co-stars of the long-running Lifetime series, Army Wives. Name two of the co-stars of the long-running Lifetime drama, Army Wives. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. And if you're first with the correct answer, you will win those prizes. I want to give a shout-out to one of our previous winners, Doug Klein Jr. of Leesburg, Ohio. He actually emailed me this morning with two of the correct answers. But unfortunately, because he's already won before, he is not eligible. So we want to make sure that we have more new people come in and get their chance to win. And thank you, Doug, for understanding. And congratulations on giving us the answer. Once again, kudos to Doug Klein Jr., one of our previous winners from Leesburg, Ohio. Again, if you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It might be your turn to win. Make sure when you email, put down your name and your full mailing address. If we don't have a winner by the end of the day, we will post the question again tomorrow on Facebook under Simon Applebaum and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's the UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, in order to win, you got to be in. So get it in and all the right best. When we come back, a major deal with CBS and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. It is a big one. We'll have that in our News Note segment. And then more about Peacock and the whole mega-forming scene with our good friend from CNNnews.com, senior reporter Joan Salzman. And oh, yes, some thoughts about the host switch that took place overnight at Dancing with the Stars. All that after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradiospeakerandsingerradio.com. Together, more than 45 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Remember, TuneIn Radio is your home for the coronavirus news channel, 24/7 developments from all around the world, plus original podcasts and more great material. The coronavirus news channel, be informed, stay in touch, TuneIn Radio, 24/7 at TuneIn.com. Welcome back to the second half of this special Peacock-oriented Tomorrow Be Televised Hour, coming your way midweek during this Wednesday of July 2020. July 15th, Eyes of June. Simon Appleband with you live from New York, 8 degrees at the top of the hour. We'll have more about Peacock and the full mega-forming scene when CNNNews.com senior reporter Joan Saltzman will join us, and she will shortly. But first, let's bring you news notes. In a landmark arrangement, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has started a TV programming venture with CBS Television Studios. On this multi-year effort, NAACP and the Viacom CBS unit will co-cause a range of scripted and nonfiction content for CBS, CBS All Access, Viacom CBS, and a variety of cable networks, and outside organizations like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, etc. A dedicated team of executives will oversee the venture. This marks the second Viacom CBS diversity expanding project announced over the last 48 hours. On Monday, CBS declared plans to allocate at least 25% of its 2021-22 season series development spending on concepts developed by creators of color. Announcements glow this afternoon for the Hallmark collection of cable services. First, Hallmark Channel will premiere 23 new Countdown to Christmas movies this holiday season, while greenlighting new seasons of When Calls the Heart, The Good Witch, and Chesapeake Shores, its ongoing series. 17 new Miracles of Christmas flicks will play late fall on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries. And Hallmark is developing a project with Tamara Molly Howery, coming off her host gig on The Real earlier this week. A couple of quickies for you. Netflix and Gaumont will join forces to bring Samurai Rabbit, based on the long-running Usagi Yojimbo comic book, to animated series life. Sony has sold its equity stake in Simon Cowell's Psycho Holdings back to Cowell. Dollar amount unknown. Psycho is the folks that do the X Factor formerly in the United States, but still going on in England. And, of course, America's Got Talent weekly on NBC. And Shark Week 2020 will begin August 9th on Discovery Channel. Opening attraction, former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson will go underwater with, you guessed it, and that's news notes for today. So with Peacock launching today, that now gives us the full scope of the mega programming ventures going on right now. It all started with last fall with BET Plus, then we had Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus, then of course we had HBO Max about a month ago, and now Peacock. And joining us live is Sy Zola, who's our very good friend from CNNNews.com, senior reporter Joan Saltzman. Hi, Joan.
Hey, Simon. It's always good to talk to you.
Same here. So let's talk Peacock for a second. What's your opening thoughts about it?
I think it's a really interesting proposition. You know, we're at the tail end of these so-called streaming wars, and a service has to pull some tricks out of its sleeve in order to get people's attention. What Peacock is doing is, you know, unlike a lot of these services that focus on big back catalogs of VOD, a video on demand, Peacock has that, but they're also going for sports and news, including some live news. And the most interesting thing to me is that they're doing this free tier, freemium model, where they have advertising on a free tier. You get the majority of the catalog without having to pay anything, as long as you watched ads, and kind of blending that with the ability to upgrade to an ad-free tier or an ad-supported tier that gives you the full catalog. Nobody has really tried that on this scale, from a company with the deep pockets and the firing power that NBC Universal has. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how this ends up fitting into the landscape.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the move that was announced earlier this week to include a Today All Day channel where you can get these 4 6-hour blocks of Today material, either recent reporting, updates on other stories, and maybe down the road we'll see original material? It sounds like this is not only a Peacock service, but also something that could be spun off as a separate service that NBC could do a lot of advertising for on smart TV sets.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how it'll live on, but it's definitely going to be living within this part of Peacock that they call channels. So it's something that a lot of these free ad-supported services do, that the Netflixes and the Hulus and the HBO Maxes don't really bother with. Peacock has created these sort of fake linear channels. They're not live channels. You can't get Bravo live stream or NBC's broadcast channel live stream, but you do get these channels like this Today All Day channel, which is kind of like a cobbling together of a linear channel from segments of Today's Show stuff, and as you said, maybe some original programming with the Today Show host down the line. I think it's a really interesting, I mean, clearly Peacock is leaning hard into the assets that they already have at NBC Universal, and this is a way for them to leverage one of their, you know, franchise, big franchises to draw in interest, draw in recognizability. But it basically comes down to whether or not these channels are good and people like watching them. And so far I haven't had enough of a chance to see if it's something that's really gripping that people will like. One thing I will say about it though, all of these channels, including the Today All Day one, is when you're on a mobile device, they automatically play sound and that drives people crazy. So maybe there'll be some product tweaks going forward too. This is only day one.
By the way, if you have a question or a comment for Joan, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Number be anywhere you're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker and TuneIn Radio, which you're catching us live on. And also, if you use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/chat. By the way, if you just came in, we're coming your way for this particular special edition, commercial-free, thanks to audible.com, and only one promotional break. That will be midway through the half hour. Joan, are consumers clear about the different tiers they can get? There is a free tier with ad support. There is where they get like 15 hours of content. There is the big tier, ad supported, with 20,000 hours of content. That's where most of the originals like Intelligence we just talked about are on. And then there is the, you want the whole thing, but you don't want the commercials, $9.95 a month.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'll be interested to see if consumers find this confusing. I know that it's been challenging for our readers to understand intuitively what it means because it's different than what they're used to, right? So explaining this to our readers leading up to launch has been kind of challenging to help them understand, wait, what do I get? And wait, I'm paying, but there's still ads on one of these things. That, I think, because it's pretty novel to the landscape, it is confusing to consumers. But now that the service is out there, you know, it does, the fact that you can log into it, just give them an email address and a password, you don't have to pay anything. It means you can get in there and start seeing what the service is. And it isn't until you reach one of those titles that's behind the paywall that you even sort of realize that there's stuff you need to pay for. Maybe the fact that there's kind of this gentle on-ramp that upsells you into a subscription, it'll be a learning tool so people can understand sort of how things work. There's no better way to understand that than to see what you get by knowing, oh, this is a title I can't have unless I pay. But I think the question makes a great point. Is this going to be something too confusing for consumers who are already dealing with this explosion in their streaming options with all these new services coming online?
The other thing that Peacock has to deal with is the impact of the coronavirus on what originals they can do. Obviously, there were a lot of originals that they wanted to get on at launch. They could not. They were hoping, of course, the Olympics would be held this month. Wasn't. It's
right.
Called at least 2021. So how does it impact their thinking about how originals will make a difference in terms of getting an audience? Because it seems that in this whole make-or-pony environment, as big as the libraries can be, it's the originals that will keep people going back and back and back and back and sort of be the sticky stuff that keeps people subscribing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The originals, although they're not the only thing people care about, they're a big thing that people care about. And also, like you said, the cadence of having buzzy originals coming out on a regular basis is what brings people back to the app. Once they've already come in and watched a little bit of things that they wanted to see, you need to have something to draw people back, and back catalog doesn't bring a service back into somebody's mind. You don't get word of mouth through movies that were released 20 years ago, although they're great to have. They don't generate buzz. And so you're right. The pandemic has been difficult for anybody that is making particularly live action TV programming right now. But services like Peacock and even other new services like HBO Max, they're at a disadvantage in that they don't have their pipeline isn't nearly as big for originals or as far along as a Netflix. As a competitor, you know, Netflix always has much more lead time for their shows than traditional TV production outfits because Netflix releases everything at once. They have to have the entire season done before episode one goes before any viewers at all. So Netflix has the benefit of not only having a huge fat pipeline, but it's a long pipeline with a lot of stuff that's already in the can. So when you're comparing yourself to a behemoth like Netflix, and the expectation for viewers is that you have to match what Netflix can deliver, it's really difficult for Peacock and HBO Max to be able to clear that hurdle. So what Peacock has said, Matt Strauss, who runs the service, what he's told me is that, you know, 2021 is really when we're going to be hitting our stride. There's not much they can do to control that. There's not a lot many people can do to control a lot of circumstances right now. And so they're really looking forward to next year as being when they're going to have all cylinders firing. And hopefully that'll make a difference. It'll make some difference and help increase the amount of interest in usership if they get to that. I mean, they will get to that point, but hopefully that will make a meaningful difference in how much people are using and enjoying Peacock.
Yeah. I was going to raise Netflix later on, but since you did, let's do it now, because tomorrow Netflix announces latest quarterly, and when they had their last quarterly, I think it really turned a lot of people's heads to exactly what you said. When Tan Serrano on that video call, the head of Netflix programming, said, we've got all of our originals for this year done, and a lot of the ones we're doing for 2021 done. And it seems that, and I'm going to be curious to see if tomorrow Ted Sarando says, hey, now that this pandemic has sort of lifted around the world, maybe we can get into production far faster than anybody else, especially here in New York, where if everything works, let's hope Mayor de Blasio is not screwing things up, personal thought, that TV and film production could come back starting Monday, and Netflix, which is working on a 6 soundstage facility in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, not to mention they've got studio space in Canada, studio space in Albuquerque, Mexico, that they could really get back very fast, even if Los Angeles doesn't, that they could get back fast in terms of getting shows up.
Yeah, I'll be interested to hear that too. And not only having all that studio capacity here in the U.S., Netflix more so than any network streaming service of this kind, it's globally sourced. You know, they're not only operating in global markets as a streaming service for consumers, but they're also producing content and greenlighting content from production companies locally in India, in South Korea, in tons, you know, in Germany, in tons of different places. And so that does give them some insulation, as even if in the United States there are flare-ups and wherever there might be rising restrictions, lowering restrictions, there's going to be places elsewhere in the world where the coronavirus is simply at a different stage of its, as you know, the pandemic is a pandemic, but it's got pockets where things are on the up and up, things are getting worse. So that should help Netflix in ramping up, hopefully, quickly. The other thing that'll be really interesting to see tomorrow is, you know, in the last quarter, it was record new subscribers, the most they'd ever had in a quarter, obviously because people are trapped in their homes. They want things like Netflix to watch. But what they learned is that they believe that that's pulled forward from later in the year and that they can't sustain that level of growth and that they might even have some falling off as people cancel, especially as cost sensitivity rises with so many people out of work, a lot more looking at your budgets. So I think it'll be interesting to see what's going on in terms of consumer interest in Netflix at this stage of the pandemic.
Incidentally, going into today, Netflix stock price above $500 a share. It has really taken off, particularly in the last week. And again, that's quarterly report will be tomorrow after the bell around 4 o'clock Eastern time, and then Netflix has that video call roughly like 5, 6 o'clock Eastern time. It'll be very interesting to see what Reed Hastings, Ted Sarandos and company have to say. One more Peacock question, then we'll move on to the whole mega-proning scene, Joan. Less than 5 minutes per hour in advertising, And also, the advertisers that are involved, remember this was on for 3 months before on the Comcast system, so they have a bunch of advertisers now, is that there's interactive ad opportunities. And I'm curious what you're thinking or what's your thoughts about the advertisers and how they're using Peacock. Is interactive advertising taking off? What's your sense about the whole interest in Peacock and their way with ads?
Well, my first impression so far of the advertising side of Peacock is that it seems like they definitely have a diversity of brands involved. You know, I haven't had a lot of time to play in the app yet, but so far the ads that I'm coming up with, there's a wide variety of them. You're not having that parroting problem that happens on some streaming services where you get the same ad over and over and over again. And I think that's partially because of, you know, NBC Universal, they've got great marketing forces, a market and advertising team there to draw in interest and also develop ad products that draw different kinds of advertising interest in. And I think also it has to do with the fact that Peacock is developed by a team that's sensitive to some of these points of tension for consumers. When you get the same ad over and over again, that's obviously not an ideal viewer experience. And so they have been building ad products, I think, to avoid those sort of situations, you know, things like these solo ads where a single advertisement, a single marketer can unlock an entire episode or entire movie by having one pre-roll ad at the beginning. So I think that they're going into Peacock with a lot of learning, a lot of expertise in marketing, and from initially, it doesn't seem like they're falling into any of the pitfalls that other services have early days when they introduce advertising in their streaming product.
We're speaking with Joan Feldman, CNetNews.com senior reporter. It's all about Peacock and the whole mega programming venture world, which we're going to get to shortly. If you have a question or comment for Joan, ring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Don't forget, Friday on Tomorrow Televised, we'll preview the brand-new TNT spinoff of their Alias miniseries from last year that did very, very well. It's called Angel of Darkness. We've got the showrunner, Stuart Caroline, will be with us. And then we'll talk Camp TV. That's the brand new public television series that started on Monday, produced here in New York by WHE 13. We'll have Lynn Toporoff, the series producer and writer. All Friday, 3:10 to noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. So, John, we now have all, we think, the mega programming venture players out there. We may still see CBS All Access go forward and try to sort of take the leap up into that stratosphere. What's your sense now about everybody and how the whole world of these ventures are doing?
Yeah, well, the bottom line of the so-called streaming wars, this wave of new services from tech and media giants, the bottom line is that nobody can hold a candle to Disney Plus. I mean, it really has blown. They blew up their own expectations about the response to Disney Plus, even at this early stage. And I think from what I can tell, watching Google Trends and other things, nobody that's launched following Disney Plus or even Apple TV, which was a couple of weeks before Apple TV Plus, nobody's even come close to the amount of interest that we've seen in Disney Plus. So they kind of wrote the playbook on how to do it and how to do it well. I don't think anyone will question whether or not Disney Plus is going to be able to sustain itself, whether it's going to be around any longer. But, you know, that's not really a question with a lot of these services. You know, most of them are being launched by gigantic corporations that are investing billions of dollars. So, and they know that the reason that they're doing that is because streaming television is something that's going to persist. It's where eyeballs are going. So it's something they have to be a part of. But among the others, beyond Disney Plus, it's really going to be interesting to see as these promotions start to expire. You know, a lot of people are watching Apple TV Plus on a 1-year free trial. That doesn't expire until basically the end of October. So it'll be interesting to see once people generally have to start paying and once there's less noise with all these promotions and free trials out of the market, then we'll start to see which ones are really resonating with consumers when they have to be paying for them and not just getting them for free.
Is it fair to say, Joan, before we go back to Apple TV Plus, is it fair to say that maybe one of the biggest moves of this year so far in television was Disney Plus' decision to premiere Hamilton?
Oh, definitely. I mean, so far this year, from what I can tell, just to give you some context, so I try to keep an eye on Google search trends in the U.S. for all these services on a semi-regular basis. And a good way to do that is to look at the interest in any of these services compared to Netflix, because Netflix has been around so long. It's the industry standard, and it has a pretty steady level of interest. It's a good gauge to look to everything else. And besides, you know, excluding Disney Plus, any of the other services that have launched, none of them have reached the level of search interest in the U.S. as Netflix has just on a day-to-day basis. Like, even on launch day, none of them have really reached that Netflix level of search interest, except for Disney Plus. The biggest spike in Disney Plus interest was on its launch day itself, and that's when it basically quintupled the amount of interest that day in Netflix. But the other day when Disney Plus had a gigantic spike, where it not only matched Netflix, and well, it doesn't matter really. The other biggest spike that it's seen, not as much as launch day, but has been that Hamilton release date right before the 4th of July weekend. There was a ton of interest in it, and it also, even though they say it wasn't on purpose, it also came 2 weeks after Disney Plus stopped offering its week-long free trials to new members. So you couldn't just sign up, watch Hamilton, not have to pay anything, and get out again. Everybody that signed up for Disney Plus to watch Hamilton, those new members were paying members out of the gate.
With Apple TV Plus, you get a sense that no matter where they're at with subscribers, it seems their programming mojo is finally, since we last talked, is finally coming together. They've gotten some raves for shows like Visible Out on Television, Little America, Truth Be Told, Dickinson won the Peabody Award the first time that a service like that has won the Peabody in the first year, which is really some special morning show. Looks like they got their act together. They've made some very interesting deals with the likes of Julie Louis-Dreyfus, the former head of HBO, Richard Pryper, formed his own production company. It seems that Apple is doubling down more on original programming than maybe we ever thought.
Well, and you know, part of the difficulty of launching a service like Apple TV Plus, which doesn't have a big back catalog of stuff, is that it makes it very apparent just how many titles you have at launch when there's nothing else for you to look at except for your originals. It just takes time when that's your strategy to start building up a library, because you can't release everything on the same day. So it definitely has been the Apple TV Plus's benefit that they do have that really extended free trial for anybody that has bought an Apple device, which is, you know, millions and millions and millions of people. And what we're seeing is that they are continuing to make really big budget investments. You know, that the Greyhound, Tom Hanks movie that was supposed to be a theatrical release in June, they paid top dollar in a bidding war to get the rights to stream that. That came out last weekend. And all that, what that does is it lends Apple TV Plus the sort of library, small as it still is, that you come to expect from a paid service. You know, you expect to go to a service like that and have options. And now we're seeing that the library that's actually in front of viewers and subscribers is one that gives them some options with what they can choose from.
Before we go, Joan, in addition to the mega programming scene developing and lots of announcements about programming possibilities popping up, two other things that are going on. One is we're seeing more and more networks at smart TV sets and smart TV devices being created and done, even in the midst of this pandemic. And secondly, there's some very interesting situations that are popping up, and I wanted to get your thoughts on two of them. One, the possibility that Walmart, which we all heard about a year ago, might really become a digital player with Vudu, and so that ultimately to Fandango, another Comcast unit. The talk about Walmart Plus becoming a rival of Amazon Plus, Amazon Prime Video, and maybe doing some sort of content work with that. And secondly, Amazon's ad-supported service, IMDb TV, which we're hearing rumors that they want to make a big push in original programming.
Yeah, those are all interesting developments for sure. There's a lot of rumbling, you know, especially around Walmart, not only on the Vudu side. Walmart made a big investment in Echo, which is an interactive video outfit. They made a huge, like a $500 million investment, I think, a couple years ago in Echo, this interactive video element. And so far, the way that they've rolled that out is in, you know, like holiday shopping season, you know, try out toy shop sort of products, you know, marketing things for merchandise. But yeah, we haven't seen much on the Vudu original content front. And I think part of that is just because it is so hard to get people's attention. The original content that Vudu and Walmart has been working on, it's hard to get people's attention. It's so busy right now. And there's so many services saying, look at me, try my service, we've got original content too, that it's really hard to break through.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, Jim, before we go, just last week, Walmart announced this Echo project called Camp by Walmart, which has celebrities sort of recreating the summer camp experience in some very interactive ways with Echo as a platform. And it's an online app, and I wonder, why isn't this an interactive TV app? Why is this not on smart TV sets and smart TV devices? I don't get it. And Walmart, by the way, just as we know, they invested $250 million in Echo. And at some point, Echo is going to become a smart TV venture. So maybe Walmart Plus might be it, and maybe the folks that have at Walmart might turn Camp at Walmart into a smart TV venture. So they say Comcast is a similar venture, which is an interactive TV venture, and that just started on their X1 and Flex platforms. If you want to know more about Joan's wonderful work, check it out. It's news.com every week. It's really great. And again, for more details about Peacock, and if you want to subscribe to that service, here's where you go, www.peacocktv.com, www.peacock.com, and catch Joan's work again at news.com 24/7. Joan, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for all the thoughts, and we will hear you down the road.
Take care, Simon. Take care.
You too, Joan. All the greatest. Joan Feldman, CNNNews.com senior reporter, joining us live from New York. Final thoughts for the day. Let's get to the chase. When it comes to live television hosting, Tom Bergeron is the master of his domain, this domain. No question about it. If you've seen his career from America's Funny Home Videos to morning news shows, the last 15 years with Dancing with the Stars, and the last six with Erin Andrews as by his side as co-host. In case you don't know, before last night, both Bergeron and Andrews announced on their social media sites that they're gone. And they did it with a lot of class, no animosity, very amicable. And then at the stroke of midnight, ABC announces Tyra Banks is the executive producer and the new host of the show. Kudos to her, all the best to her. And when it comes to Tom Bergeron, like the great saying goes, when one door closes, another door opens. Believe me, big door opening for Tom Bergeron in the future. And when he does, it's going to be great. Thanks to all our guests for being here, and all of you as well. Back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific right here. On tomorrow, we'll be televised. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not those of Block Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Our production associate, Amanda Lynn, Annie Coe's Block Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, head of content. The co-founders of this enterprise are Al Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow, we talk about the brought to you commercial free this afternoon by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For 1 month trial, one audio book, and more, it's audibletrial.com/televised. But tomorrow, we televise. I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. A great rest of your week. We are back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. You know where? Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, and the iRadio Podcast Network. Remember, whatever you're up to now and then, please make it safe and make it great. And let's live this pandemic now and forever. Wear that mask. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.